Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and have a great day.
You see, there was another wino here, got his birthday cake. I wonder if he was under the same freeway bridge as I was years ago. I'm still driving. You'll have to excuse me a little bit. I swear to God, I kept looking for Palm Desert, through Palm Springs and Cathedral City and all that. I thought, nope, I got it wrong again. It's funny how people call you up to speak at an AA meeting. They say, will you show up? I say, sure. And all of a sudden they hang up and they don't realize that I don't know where in the hell they are, you know? They've been going there for years. I haven't, you know. But that's what I like about alcoholics. They're very thorough. I don't know how you got this program, but I had a mother on this program. And she and a gal friend of hers by the name of B. Follett, her name was at that time. Maybe some of you gals know her as B. She's my sponsor, and those two broads used to drag me around AA. So that's how I got acquainted with Alcoholics Anonymous. They would build up some pretentious story about two broads stuck on a Pacific Coast highway with a broken-down automobile, subject to all sorts of violations, right? And finally, I'd look at them and say, okay, I'll drive you, all right? So we'd get in the car, and we'd go to the AA meetings, and they'd come in, and everybody'd say, hi, B, hi, Irene, how are you? You know, loving each other up. And they'd turn around, and they'd say, oh, this is Chuck. And so two guys would look at me, and they'd say, oh, you're Chuck, come with us, you know? It was the same old routine. They would sit there, and they would talk about their drinking. And I used to say to B and Mom, you know, your drinking is not your obsession. My drinking is your obsession. Will you two broads get the hell away from me, you know? And it never occurred to me until after I got on the program that any guy in his right mind would have never approached these two broads. I don't care where they were, see? And so that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And Fee said to me one night, she said, honey, why don't y'all try to identify? I said, what do you mean, B? And she says, well, listen to the speaker. Maybe he's reading y'all's mail. So I said, hell, I'm not going anywhere. I'll listen to this one, you know. So he comes out, and his name is Red. Now, Big Red stood about 6 inches taller than I am. He had hands like shovels. He was a huge fella. And he started out, and my God, I'd never heard anything like this in my life. This guy had been on the rock, out of the rock, been connected with prostitution, rum running, counterfeiting, Murder Incorporated, Rapes Anonymous. This guy was whatever they say. I'm sitting on the edge of my seat like a gangbusters night. I'd never heard anything in my life. I looked over at B and said, identify. I'd have to take alcohol enemas to catch up with this guy. And then there was another night we were there, and you ever have the feeling, if you're an alcoholic or have those tendencies, you ever have the feeling somebody's staring at you? Well, I was sitting up in the front row with B and Mom waiting for them to give their pitch, and all of a sudden I look over and there's an old guy staring at me. Here, give me that thing. I'll bust this thing. Here. This way. Here. This is how you get sober. We did it. Give her a hand. Jerry, did you ever do that? You ever, I remember that brought back a memory, I'll tell you. Woo-hoo. I had one. I had gone out and I bought a brand new Mercury convertible, red. And this is back in the days when he had those huge bumpers, the booby bumpers on them. And I come driving home and I back it, mailbox, rose bushes and all in the garage, and I go to sleep, pass out, I should say. And all of a sudden I hear my little daughter saying, "Come on, Daddy, take us for a ride in our new car, ar. And I'm like, I just heard something, you know. And second time she said, "Daddy, take us for a ride in our new car, ar. I jumped up and I said, "What car?" I scared the hell out of this kid. And she said, "Oh, Daddy, you're so funny. Our new car, come on." So I thought, oh, my God, what have I done, you know? So I went and I peeked out the Venetian blinds, and there stood that monster with his face hanging out of the garage. And I thought, oh, my God, I've heard about this in AA. So I went out and I pulled the garage door down, and the kids would throw it back up again. And like I said, trying to get the bottle open, and I went into this little bathroom we had standing there, you know? And I remember standing in front of the sink, and I had this pint, and I was trying to get that lid up. When they put that damn plastic around there, you know, and you're trying to get the thing undone, you know, and I'm standing in front of the mirror saying, "Oh, boy, Chuck, you've done it again. Oh, what are you going to tell him this time? Boy, you owe your dad about $900. You owe Fred over at the grocery store, Jimmy down at the filling station." I said, "You're going to drive up in that," and they say, "Oh, boy, Charlie finally hit it. Now we get paid, you know." I said, "Boy, you've really fixed yourself up. How in the hell you could..." This son of a bitch, and I'm trying to get this thing undone. Well, just as about I'm ready to break its neck over the sink, it comes unglued, you know. So I take a big swig of this, and I'm standing there saying, "Now, what am I going to tell these people? Damn it, I know I got to think of something. Oh, boy, Charlie, you've really done it." I'm looking at myself in the mirror, you know. I'm saying, "Ooh, you really done it this time." And I'm taking another drink, and then finally I said, "What the hell am I excited about? I deserve a new car." Just reminded me of it, trying to get that damn thing open. I used to hear the word insanity from the podium, and I thought, insane, what the hell are they talking about? Doesn't everybody live like this? And so that was my introduction to AA. And all those things that I had heard from the podium, I hadn't done yet, so I had to go on my way. And needless to say, that it didn't take too long. It didn't take too long. It was just a couple of three or four more years. And I ended up a wino under the freeway bridges. Now, that's when they were building the Ramona Freeway to get out here to San Bernardino. They used to call the San Bernardino Freeway the Ramona Freeway. And they used to build the bridges first. And I was way the hell out in the country, sitting under with my old 1941 Oldsmobile with steel floor and headliner to match. And my wine bottle, dreaming those dreams. Wondering what happened to the boy genius. What happened to all those things that we were going to be, you know? Identify. You know, I had trouble with that word, identifying. And these words that I heard from this podium, I had trouble with. You see, I come from an alcoholic family. My mother was an alcoholic and my father was a wino. And unless you come from that kind of environment, unless you come from that kind of instability, it's pretty difficult for a child to find any kind of an identity. All I did was I wanted out. And so I got out of high school early. I had one of those kind of minds. And so I wanted to get away. I was tired of the constant battling and game playing and always blaming it on the kids or somebody else. The whole childhood was nothing but chaos. Few people here know my mom since she got sober, and she was quite a manipulative broad sober. You should have seen her when she was drinking. And so I graduated from high school early. I got interested in airplanes. And I went to Lincoln Aeronautical Institute. And when I graduated from there with a engineering degree and a full pilot, the war was declared. So I became a brand new second lieutenant in the Air Corps in the training command. And when I got the hell out of that, I was always looking for identity of some kind. And I remember in high school, I tried to be cheerleader. So when people would say to me, "What are you, little boy?" I could say I was a cheerleader. I was always trying to be something. In fact, I had a saying when we were drinking, let's get drunk and be somebody, because I didn't know what the hell I was. And so when I got out of the service arena, a buddy of mine, we went in the building business, and I realized I needed some more education. So I went back to college and became a registered architect, always seeking some kind of an identity. And it was there, because I hated alcohol, it was there in the building business that I became acquainted with booze, because out on the job back, what happened was when I got out of the service, I was in St. Louis, Missouri, I came back home and got married, my wife got pregnant, we went back to Missouri, and that's where I got into the building business and in the architectural practice. And back there, for every four guys you got on the job, at 10 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon, you got to have four bottles of beer for them, or it's bye-bye, Charlie. So they used to chug-a-lug with the beer there. And they used to say to me, come on, chug-a-lug with the beer there. Can't you drink like a man? And a few years later, they're looking at me and saying, my God, can't you drink like a man, you know? And so needless to say, I lost all of that. In fact, when I was back there, I even ran for state senator. Always wheeling and dealing. And when I came to California, naturally, that's when my mother drugged me around and introduced me to AA. But I had to continue on. I had to go down that trail. I had to do all those things that I'd heard from the podium. And when I came into AA 31 years ago, there were nothing but a bunch of guys my age, a bunch of old farts. I didn't like old farts then. I don't like them today. And they used to call me the kid, and they'd say, how much do you drink, kid? And I'd say, oh, about 3/5 of wine a day. And they'd say, hell, we used to spill that much when we got the first one down. All over our tie or shirt or whatever. And I learned a lot of tricks going to those meetings, because I always had trouble getting that first one down in the morning. And I learned about how to do with the towel and the glass and all of those things. I learned about hiding the booze. I don't know about you. Did you ever wake up and you look outside and it's dark? You don't know what time it is, but it's dark. And you think, oh, my God, did I leave anything? You know, you look over at her and say, boy, she poured it out. I'll kill her, you know. And then you say, no, I don't want to wake up the bear. And so you're out of bed. You're going through the cabinets. You're going through everything. And you say, God, I can't find anything. And I was really getting nervous time, you know. And I say, oh, I know, out in the front ivy. I hit some out in the front ivy. And you're out there on your hands and knees in that wet, sloppy ivy, you know, those snails going, you know. And the dogs are barking, and first thing you know, they're helping you hunt for whatever the hell you're hunting for. I trained a lot of bottle retrievers there in West Covina. And so it finally happened. It finally happened. I remember my mom and dad used to come out, and no people, did anybody ever look at you and say, if it makes you sick, why do you drink? That used to get to me. And the other one was, I'd be sitting in this overstuffed chair of mine in my own urine and other foreign objects, and this well-meaning person would look at me and they'd say, Chuck, why don't you use your willpower? If I had any willpower, I'd use it on my bladder, right? And like all good winos, I used to get angry, and I'd stand up and suck wind, you know, suck. And it's difficult when we're drinking, you know, those dreams, those hopes and those wishes. And you know the disappointment we would see on the people's faces. But that didn't touch anything to the disappointment that I had for myself. It's difficult for the non-alcoholic to understand this agonizing feeling that you and I get. We talk about it as a lonesomeness. We talk about it as those promises failed, not to the other people. But as I used to sit there and dream of those things that I was going to do, tomorrow it was going to happen. I was always at planning and everything else, and always I would end up with that wine bottle. See? That wine bottle. And I remember I used to stand in front of that same little mirror there where I almost broke the neck off of that bottle. And I used to say, by God, I'm going to beat this thing. And those crocodile tears would run down my face, you know. And I'd say, I'm going to beat this thing, because my mom and dad had just been out, and I'd seen him walk out to the car with my wife, completely ignoring me. And that's what used to get to us. I don't know about you, but what used to get to me was the way that they would act towards us, you and I, this hopelessness, this thing that they, not so much what they said, but that innuendo of treatment. Not only was the agony of my own broken promises to myself, but this constant aggravation of lack of understanding, as I thought it was. And having that alcoholic personality of always screaming out for that justice, you know? And so this used to tear at my very soul. And I would go in there and I'd cry and those tears would run down. And I'd say, I'm going to show them I can beat this thing. I'm going to prove it to them. By God, I'll get a job and I'll pay them back every damn dime with interest, too. You know, I'd go all through that thing, you know, and I'd go in and sit down and have another drink, you know. The hopelessness. No wonder the non-alcoholic would look at us and shake our heads, shake their heads. And I would get this thing about all that you have, all this education, all these degrees. Why are you wasting this? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? Sure, I didn't have any answers. I didn't know what I was. Because a feeling was dead. How do you identify with no feeling? How do you identify when you're the problem yourself? And that's the amazing thing about this Alcoholics Anonymous is that if we finally have some place to go where there's other identities. But when you're sitting there alone with that drink, how do you identify being the problem? Because if you're like me, deep down in that gut, there's that one wish that tomorrow I'm going to do something about it. Tomorrow morning when I wake up, that's what I'm going to do. And I used to write notes, and I used to try to plan, and I used to try to do all of these things, you know, all of the rules of the how-to books. And you see, where is the power of those education? Where is the power of these diplomas? Where is the power of all this knowledge? You see? Alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Do you know that you and I are the most written up people in the world? If you'd like to really search and find out about alcoholism, the medical libraries have got stacks of information on you and I. This disease has baffled nations, civilizations for thousands of years. And only in this millennium have we found this thing, this fellowship of you and I, where we can share. And it's strange how they gave it to him, the alcoholic, this wonderful program. And so when I finally came to Alcoholics Anonymous for me, I met my Waterloo on Old Highway 39, which is Glendora Boulevard in West Covina. Now, this is over, like I say, 31 years ago, before it was a bedroom town. The farms and the walnut trees and the orange trees and the zinnias. They used to plant acres of zinnias out there. My God, those things went everywhere. The only entertainment we had was the crop dusters coming by, you know, dumping that thing. We didn't know from ecology then. And so in my walking all up Old Highway 39, I had gotten in a fight with my wife, and I'd taken her grips, and I'd packed my clothes in them, and I said, I'm going to leave you, and I'm going to Las Vegas, and I'm going to win some money and come back and shove it you know where, and I took off. Well, they had planted full acreage of cabbage and cauliflower out behind me. So I went out the back door and right through the cabbage patch and over into the cauliflower field. Do you ever try to walk through one of those sober? You got to be real loaded and carrying two heavy grips. And I get out in the middle of this cauliflower field and I take the tall grip and I stand it up on end. Then I put the short one on top of that. And I pull out these 2 pints that I had there and I said, we'll now have an AA meeting. And so I told that one cauliflower head that looked like B just what I thought of her. The other one looked like my mother and Stu and Art and a lot of the other guys. And I said, up yours. And I picked up my grips and I went over to Highway 39. As I was walking along, all of a sudden something happened to me. I fell on my knees between those two grips on old Highway 39. I began to sob from down in my gut. And I never will forget that night. It was something I had no control over. It was something I didn't instigate. But when I was finished, I picked myself up, and I remember looking up. It was a big, beautiful moonlit night, and I said, oh, God, help me, I'm an alcoholic. And I went back home, and I called some AA people. Now, I want you to know that I was known as the biggest phony in the Pomona Covina Valley, because I used to run in and out of AA to get my mother off my ass, right? And I'd play that, oh, Mom, I'm not going to do it again. I think I got the program this time. And when I'd go in there, I'd say, I don't want to hear about the damn program. I know all about it. My mother drags me around. I know about the steps and everything else. What I want to know is, how do I take care of the rent? What do I do about this? How do I handle my old lady? What am I going to say to my boss? All of these other things, see? And that's the thing that used to get to me. And when I'd go to AA meetings with my mom, and they talk about sobriety. I could never catch on to this. When they talk about sobriety from this podium, it always confused and frustrated me because I had been sober many times. You know, but these damn AAs, they talk about like some mystical happening, you know? And it used to frustrate me. I'd been sober many times and I'd play that game of trying to get in good graces, covering all my debts, getting to the boss, trying to get new jobs, trying to do all these various things. I had had that kind of sobriety. And so the word sobriety kind of frightened me. But I noticed when you talk to AAs, they talked about it in some different kind of vein. All these words, words, words that I used to hear from this podium used to drive me crazy. What the hell is that this AAs talk about? And so when I called them, they said, well, you've been drinking? I said, hell yes, I've been drinking. What do you think I called you for, you know? And so they said, well, smart ass, if you can get sober by Tuesday night, we'll come by and pick you up and take you to the Arcadia meeting. So you'll hear it said many times, new people, I went to bed that night and I had a good night's sleep. Now, you know that space picture where they had the Jedi and all that stuff, and when a guy landed on that planet and he went in the bar and all those strange creatures were there. Used to drink with those people. I've seen things that Spielberg would like to have copies of. I had one who used to come in at 3 o'clock in the morning, kick the end of the bed, and I'd wake up, and he looked like Quasimodo from The Hunchback of Notre Dame, except he was, his teeth were growing out here, and the one eye was down there, and he had a big cyst or something on his head. And I would get up, and I'd say, I told you not to come back here again, and I'd go to the front door, and I'd slam the front door, and the house would go bloom, you know, and then it'd settle down for the night. Well, this night, this character didn't show up. I got a good night's sleep. But the next morning, I woke up, boy, and that thing had started. That thing in your gut. You know that high vibration? That zzzz thing was going. Have you ever done the sheet dance? That's where you get, you're laying in bed. You know, you haven't got the full whips yet, but that frequency's going, you know, and you get the sweats, and then you pull a sheet up over you. Then you get hot, and you roll it down the end of the bed, and it gets all tangled up in your feet. Then you get up and try to pie fold it. You try to do all those things with that damn sheet, and then you get up to leave the room, and you forget what the hell you're leaving for, and then you turn around and light a cigarette, and you got four going, you know. That was just how it started. And I was going, ooh, like this, and my wife would say, where does it hurt? I said, I don't know, it keeps moving, damn. You know. So needless to say, I went through 3 days of hell, scared the hell out of my family, swimming across the living room floor like a dolphin, beating the walls and screaming and hollering. So she went next door and she said, my God, I think he's dying. He's laying there. He's stiff as a board. His eyes are rolled back and there's something running out of his mouth. And they said, well, we don't know what to do. Why don't you call his AA friend? She says, oh, my God, I never thought about that. So she dials, found a number, and she dialed. And they said, well, what's he doing? She describes all this stuff to him. And she says, what'll I do? And they said, nothing. Let the son of a bitch sweat it out. He'll remember this one. She said, what? She hung up the phone. Well, when I finally came out of that, I had those wino whips. Do you know what I'm talking about? That's where you wear your clothes out from the inside, you know? I was at a 12-step house the other, just about a year ago, and they brought a little guy up by the name of Patrick. And he looked like that guy on TV that always looks nervous, you know? Except Don Knotts. Except he was about 4 or 5 RPMs ahead of Don Knotts. He was standing there, you know, waiting to see if they're going to take him in. And he was doing one of these things. And I said, Pat, and he'd go, what? You know, like it was God calling, you know. And I said, man, you don't know how I appreciate seeing you. I said, my God, I forgot what it was like. He said, well, what the hell are you talking about, you know? And that's the way I was. Boy, I had those wino whips, man, and I was just shaking all over. In fact, my wife had to help me get dressed, except it was pretty dangerous. Because once in a while, one arm would go like this, and then another one out like that, you know, and all the kids are standing back, don't get near the sumbitch, I'll kill you. And so I never forget, I'm standing there, I'm looking, I'm saying, am I okay, honey? And she says, you look fine, you know. So I didn't know what to do with my hands. I didn't want to put them in my pockets because I wasn't feeling romantic that night. In fact, you know how they turn the car off and the diesels? I was down at the market near my house a while back, and the guy got out and he turned it off. And he's standing there looking at it while it's still running. I looked at him, I said, my God, I used to be just like that. That's why my wife won't go with me anyplace. We were in Hughes Market coming in, and there was a little old lady, she's like this, and she's bent over trying to pull two baskets apart, you know? So I walked by her, and I said, throw a bucket of water on them. My wife goes this way, the little old lady collapsed in the basket. I got two women avoiding me in that market. That old lady and my wife. She says, get the hell away from me. I don't know you. Yeah. Oh, my. So that's the way I was that night. So this guy comes and he knocks on the door and he takes one look at me standing there, you know, doing my Don Knotts thing and trying to control myself and like this, you know. He takes a look at me and he says, oh, my God. I said, please, I've scared him enough. I got to get to the meetings. Please, please take me. So he says, okay, come on. So we get down the other step in this little gravel driveway. I got a two-bedroom shack in West Covina there. We get down and this guy's got a brand new Pontiac. This is when a two-tone first came out in the 50s, you know. And it's metallic green. And it's got forest green on it. I'm a car freak anyhow, and I stand there, you know. Boy, isn't that pretty, you know. So we get up to the car, and he starts to put the key in, and he freezes, and I'm standing there, you know. What the hell are we waiting for, you know? And all of a sudden, he looks over at me, and he looks back at that car. And he just keeps looking at me and back. Finally, it dawns on me, as stupid as I was. I said, don't worry, man. I don't have anything left to throw up on that thing. He said, you sure? All the way to the meeting, he was going, you all right? I'm saying, yes, my God, I'm fine. You know? Then I get to the meeting, and here they come, all them happy alcoholics. How are you, Jack? I said, get the hell away from me. Jesus, just take me and let me alone, you know? So it was a women's club, and they had this little metal wicker chairs are about this wide. That always fascinated me. How do you get those broads, get their big ass on that little... and sit there for hours playing bridge. So I'm sitting on this thing and it's going blink, blong, blink, blong, blink, blong. So I thought I was disturbing this little old lady in front of me. So I get up and leaned against that sandblasted wall I had and sandpapered myself to death. And the Scotsman is up there talking about AA, and he's giving it hell, and I'm saying, give it to me, you son of a bitch. I gotta make this program. Oh, shit, what do I say to people when they offer me a drink? You know, I didn't even realize that was progress, you know? And back in those days, they had a cure for everything. Now, when I was a kid, if I had snotty nose, constipation, stomach ache, fever, no matter what I had, my mother gave me castor oil and orange juice. They had a cure for everything called Caro syrup and orange juice. But I didn't know that, see? So they're afraid I'm having a sugar drop or a rush. I don't know what the hell it is. Because I'm whipping all over the place and sweating and turning gray and blue and everything else. So they bring me this thing of Caro syrup and orange juice. And I don't know what it is. And all of a sudden, they give me a big tablespoon of that stuff. It hits my mouth, and I got a recall of this castor oil and orange juice. And I'm going... They had a cure for everything called Carol syrup and orange juice. But I didn't know that, see? So they're afraid I'm having a sugar drop or a rush. I don't know what the hell it is, because I'm whipping all over the place and sweating and turning gray and blue and everything else. So they bring me this thing of Carol syrup and orange juice. And I don't know what it is. And all of a sudden, they give me a big tablespoon of that stuff. It hits my mouth, and I got a recall of this castor oil and orange juice. And I'm going,
What was so easy?
And they're not getting close, man. They're saying, well, what the hell's he saying? You know, I'm saying, you know, and finally one guy says, I think he's asking what it is. It's Carol syrup and orange juice. I said, Oh. So there I've got me out in the kitchen pouring this crap down in me, you know. I don't know whether it helped or not. But so that was my first night in AA. That was for me. And like all new people, I had those millions of questions in the back of my head. What do you do about this? What do you mean by that? And I just go to those meetings and drive those guys nuts. But the thing that always got to me about this program was this, you see, the progression of this disease I could understand because I had been around long enough to see those that didn't make it go out and never come back. So I understood the physical side of this thing. I didn't have any trouble identifying with the physical aspects of this disease as far as I was concerned for myself. Because when I had those whips and those shakes and those many times, those aches and pains and those things that go with this disease physically, it's not hard to accept the fact that you've got a disease, a disorder. But this thing always bothered me was this, coupled with an obsession of the mind. As I told you, I have one of those kind of brains. And so as I went on and on, sobriety came to me that was just as cunning and baffling as drinking was. I thank God I had some old-timers there. And back in those days, if you had 8 years, you were an old-timer. There were intelligent men, and they told me, as they said in the, as it says in the book, you may have also to find answers elsewhere, Charlie. And so I went back outside of AA. No, I didn't leave AA. I still continued my program. In fact, I was secretary and a lot of other things. But I went on a 12-and-a-half-year search. Now, this took me through back through college and the psychologies, the philosophies, the divinities. I went through four different metaphysical institutions. I've been taught by Tibetans, yogas, masterminds, great minds. Searching and seeking for this thing. Because this chapter 5, New People on How It Works, is how it works. These steps, they talk about the spirituality of this program. This frustrated me because you see on this step 3 where they talked to me and they said, God as you understood him. You see, that's a self-responsibility. God, as I understand. That's why I say this is an individual program. And so this sent me off on this search. You know, my searching and seeking through all of these various trainings. I see people today studying these Oriental philosophies. But you see, they took me and they first had to teach me how to think like an Oriental. I'll just give you a little example. If I give you my pitch where I talked about the bottle, if I talk about my drunk a lot, if I really get into bringing the wild horses home to my little ranch in West Covina, my 50 by 110 foot lot, if I talk about those things, you see, the Occidental, we kind of people get involved in the drama, where the Oriental will listen to the story and seek the message. And so the symbologies, all of the things that you read, like in the interpretation of the Bible, is a Persian-based book that's predicated upon Oriental philosophy. The symbologies, the parables, all of these things have a relationship to a message. And so they had to teach me how to think like an Oriental before they could teach me the philosophy. And so in the searching and seeking, as I went through all of these things, I remember one day I had books up the kazoo, notes and all this other thing. And I remember walking over this. I had a little room. It was about 12 by 14, I think, or 13, 6 or 9. And I walked over at this window, and I remember looking up, and I said, Dear God, please, you've shown me all the great minds of the world. Please, may I have a message of my own. And I went on about my business. Well, it was that next day or the day after I woke up, and there sat on the side of the bed was the old Mexican menu. Now, for you new people, you see the blue cover on the jacket on the book. Back in those days, we had an orange and white and yellow cover on there, and it had Alcoholics Anonymous in script across there. And we used to call it the Mexican menu because that's what it looked like, one of those covers. And so I started opening up this book, and I started rereading it. And it seemed that all those questions that I had asked about the progression of the disease, what do they mean by these words that I hear from this podium in Alcoholics Anonymous? Because it was frustrating, it was confusing, baffling to me. The structure of these steps, all of these things that I wondered about in this program, I begin to get the answers to. And so it's strange how my higher power talks to me, because in this progression of this disease, I couldn't find this thing which was tied into the obsession of the mind. And a lot of people, especially new young people, ask me, well, with 31 years, how do these steps still apply to you? You see, my life is still unmanageable because they're talking to me about the residual of the alcohol, that personality that was developing. As I'll explain to you the things that I've discovered, I'm sharing with you my AA program. This is what I have discovered over the years in and on the program. And so as I got into these steps, I was coming home from a bull session with some intellectual buddies of mine. I don't know why you people want to be normal. I counsel a lot of normies. And so as I was coming home, I remembered the story that this man was talking to us that evening, and he was talking about an ancient lake. And the things that he described from this lake were fantastic. How the recordings of this thing, and I said to him at that evening, I said, how do you read this? He said, every event upon event that happened there left an implant, and we learned how to recognize those events. And so as I was driving home, I said, my God, that's my answer to that question that I asked about the progression of the disease coupled with the obsession of the mind. Because you see, I'm the sum total of everything I've ever been. So when I react emotionally, where am I coming from? You see, medical science says that I react emotionally in about 1/3200 of a second. So I'm that sum total. You see, I had pre-drinking, drinking, and then non-drinking. All of these events upon events upon events are the sum total of what I am. You see, and so when I quit drinking, I thought, like, I'd always thought that if I quit drinking, everything else would be all right. I was always generalizing. You see, if I just had a better wife or a better car or better this or better that, everything else would be all right. And when I was in that spiritual search, if I could just find that one key, then everything would be all right. I would have that spirituality, you see? That alcoholic trait, that alcoholic personality. And so I see today, I realized that all I had done was stop drinking, but that personality had continued on, you see? And so, new people, let's not forget where we're coming from. It says in the book we're not saints, but I haven't met an alky yet that believes that. You noticed? Every once in a while they'll flip their cork and they'll blow their stack and all of a sudden they'll look around to see if there's any members or Easy Does It bumper stickers, you know, and then they'll say, I'm not supposed to act that way. I'm on the program. I think that's funnier than hell, you know. I really get a kick out of that one, you know. I got news for you. I got 31 years and I still blow my top. The only difference is now I don't give a shit who's around. That's the difference. I don't know why they think, because you see, new people, there's no seniority on this program. All I got is longevity. The only thing is what I start with each day. I still hurt. I still get mad. I've still got problems. People don't act the way I'd like for them to. All of these things I've still got. I don't know why they think you're supposed to become some super entity because you read one lousy book that says AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and you've tried to follow these steps. Are you supposed to become some super being? I don't know. I don't understand that outlook. And some of the gurus I hear around here drive me crazy in this organization. I'm still working on things. Thank God I'm feeling. Thank God I'm doing. I was so well trained, I told you in those teachings, that I became an automaton. Nothing could reach me. I had reached that state. If you want to go through those trainings, good luck. When you get there, it's nothing. That's what they tried to tell me when I was searching for it. And so I had to learn to feel again. Now, I'd like to explain the difference between feel and emotion. Emotions are just impulses. I'm not talking about feel. I'm talking about a relationship with the inner self, which this thing has helped me structure. Because in this step one, that my life had become unmanageable. You see that progression of that disease, that reaction factor of what I am. I'm the sum total of things that happened to me. I can't deny what has happened to me. I can't deny those results of the validity of my own experiences. You see, so I have to react. They promised me that I would have life. You see, I just didn't know what the hell they were talking about. And so in those promises, as you get into this step five and you start working these steps, it said much shall be revealed to you. It said that God could store me, restore me to sanity. He didn't say it would. And what is the definition of sanity? Reasonable thinking. And so as I said, when I got to this step three, and they said, God, as I understood him, it made my responsibility to my relationship to this higher power. And so as I begin to test this thing, as I begin to look at it, my God, I had one that was fantastic. It was a lawyer, an accountant, or a salesman, all depending on what the hell I wanted to use them for in that particular deal or that particular relationship for that particular deal. I even see some of the young ladies and men looking for him, trying to get him to be a marriage counselor, or trying to get him to be a pimp, or trying to get him to be what do they call those, escort services, or meet a bride, or whatever the hell they are, you know? I see all these examples. But I was there. I had used that kind of a God. And I know that you, if you're anything like me, we want a spiritual report card. We like to know how we're going on. I heard the guy say, what step are you on? I had a baby of mine. He's got about 9 months. He's one of those kids that ask all the right questions. I don't know how in the hell I got him. But he called me up the other night and he said, after he talked to me a while, he said, what the hell step am I on? I said, you're still on step one like the rest of us. But I said, two and three are working for you. You just don't know that yet. But so as you get into these steps, you see, they begin to take on a reality. And around here, you'll hear people say, have you taken your inventory? They left out a word. It says moral inventory. And so as I begin to read that, I said to myself, what the hell do they mean by placing that moral there? Because I have found that in reading this book, as I read it today, not like I used to read it. I used to read it with this intellectual horseshit and try to read into it what I thought they were saying, you see? And this showed up in step four. Because they had put that word moral in front of the inventory. And so I said, what do they mean by this? And this puzzled me for a while until I got into the word moral, which has its roots in mores. And I began to research the thing because I had an understanding of moral. You see, I understand judicial, paternal, social, religious, philosophical, institutional, tribal, morals. And as I begin to break these down into areas, I thought, my God, that's what that means. You see, I'm a many-compartmental being. But I was always looking for that one moral principle, and if I found that, everything else would be all right. I had taken many a moral inventory. And as I began to reread these things, I had found out that all I'd done was step five. I've written down the nature of my wrong. You see, when you get into the moral inventory, it's immoral and amoral. And so as I begin to seek these different compartments of my life, now how does this anonymous wino talk to me from the inside, emotionally? When do I call you up? When everything's going good? Hell no, man, I'm going to enjoy it because I don't know when it's going to end. But the minute I get in trouble, then I start calling around, right? And what's the trouble? The emotions. Because as the alcoholic, I'm emotionally disturbed. I'd like to say sick, but I got a little pride, you know. And so as we get into the emotions of this thing, we begin to see what I was. When I say we, I'm talking about me and this wino on the inside. And so as I begin to see how it was talking to me, I begin to see those areas in which I was having the greatest difficulty. And at that particular time, it was sex, finances, work, home, education and politics is the way it kind of broke down for me in the beginning. And so when I went into this sexual immoral inventory, I was surprised how ignorant I was. I used to say I was overqualified for sobriety. As I got into this thing, all the way from the little kid in the reading the 30 words on the wall up to what I thought it ought to be, could be, or should be. And so the emotional games I was playing with it, the setups. You see, around here, you'll hear a word called rejection. You see, if you're like I am, the typical alcoholic doesn't know the difference between disagreement, rejection, and opinion. You see, whenever I was in a disagreement, I would take that as a rejection. You see, because the game that I was playing with my wife and this maneuvering, this manipulation, which we call romance, all of these games that were played with this thing, you see? And then how I would use it, like I said in my report card, I'd look for a spiritual report card because I want to know what kind of progress I was making. And if I was getting laid, the boss was treating me nice, the kids were not sick, that damn car was running right, and everything was going good, the weather was fine, boy, you ought to talk to my higher power. I got the spiritual side of this program like you wouldn't believe, right? All of a sudden, everything had turned to crap, and I'm saying, what are you doing this to me for? I've been a good boy. Why are you treating me like that? My God, I've been sober. You know, God, quit picking on me, you know. 4 billion people on the face of the earth, and he picks me out, right? And so, as I get into this moral inventory, I begin to discover many aspects. We'll take finances. Now, I finance subdivisions, I finance motion pictures, I finance all this stuff. But the guy said to me, he said, hey, smart ass, what's your bank balance? I said, hell, I don't know. So I had to sit down and do a moral inventory about this. I was always getting in trouble financially because I was predicating upon a come bet, a future deal, the things I had going. I was never dealing with the reality of what the hell I had and could never figure out why I was always in this financial sweat. Some of the damn car deals I made. I used to buy a car every time I got emotionally upset. I don't know whether any of you have ever done that. I thought, now this will make it better. I'll look good, you know. I must have paid in my lifetime $100,000 in interest. And a few other things they gave me. And so as I got into this financing, I began to straighten that out. You see, I'm talking about the emotional areas of my life. What is the moral structure of this individual, this being? What are his standards? What are these things? Who judges me? You? Sure you will. It's natural. Somebody's out there taking my inventory right now. Some bitch didn't say this and he didn't say that. That's okay. You got to practice on somebody? Pick on me. But who really judges me? My mother? Who is it that says to the wino that he had to have those degrees? Who is it said to have a house on the hill? Who has said I had to have the horses, the boats, the big cars, the airplanes? My mother? Who set up all this stuff? And then who turns around and judges the wino? You see? How is this wino, how is this alcoholic going to have a chance with a righteous son of a bitch like me over him? You see? And so as I begin to get into this moral inventory, I begin to see what they were trying to point out to me. Because when I got into work, people asked me what I did. It used to take me 45 minutes to tell them how great I was. Then if the boss or whoever I was working with didn't come by and tell me what a great job I was doing, I'd be insulted. It never occurred to me that I present my credentials, the people hire me, and they pay me. They say, thank you, you know? I had to make a big deal out of it. That showed up down here in this word, politics. And so when I got into education, family, I didn't know what the hell a family was. I've had 7 children. That's the strangest experience in the world. You're a young man, they come out and hand you a baby and tell you you're a father. You turn it over and you look in the crack, see if there's any notes. What the hell's a father, you know? I guess this is, you know. Here, you better take it, it's leaking, you know? And so it doesn't matter. Even if I knew what it was, my kids would have told me I didn't do it right anyway. Got him. But I got him. This is a very interesting meeting. We kill bugs, we open cans. Everybody comes in new in AA, and they say, I wonder what those people are all about. They're about this far off the floor and about 40 miles out that way. And so as you get into this moral inventory, you see, for me, it began to take on a new structure. It began to show me a survival. It began to show me a way out. It began to have something that was introducing me to something that I am. It began to show me the nature of my wrongs and what was behind them. And so as I got into the education, I realized that I was overeducated for AA. I had to go back and re-educate myself. Because this is a simple program. If you think I'm kidding, talk to the academia about us. You see, the academia is always looking for a formula. I know, I was a member of that group. You see, when you talk to me about principles as an engineer, I look for formula. I can't tell you how many years I was on this program looking for the formula. You see, then you connect it with something abstract like spirituality. You really drive them out the street. And some of you are too young to remember, but back in the days when this thing first started here in the West Coast, it was difficult to find churches that would let us meet like this. We would go into them and tell them about the spiritual group we had and, oh, doctors and lawyers. And we'd give them the bullshit. You know, we're really good at that. And they'd say, oh, my, that sounds so fascinating, a spiritual program, and you have all those people, and, oh, I think we can arrange something. And then they'd say, what do you call yourselves? And we'd say, Alcoholics Anonymous, and then watch them turn gray. And they'd say, oh, I don't know, I think we better talk to the committee. We'll get back to you, you know. And then we'd go outside and say, well, we lost that one, you know. And, of course, our good old American Legion didn't want us around because they had a bar there, and if we'd have dried them out, that division had gone under, you know. So we had our times. But getting back to this step four and how it works for me. You see, when I got into this education, I began to realize that I had to learn a new language because these AAs talk. They use the same words, but they seem to have different meanings. You see, I couldn't understand. I had a great deal of trouble with this word honesty. And so when I finally worked it out, this is what I've discovered for me about working this thing honesty. Because, you see, in these trainings and these various things I have, I understand suppression, the results of suppression, the creation of inner pressures and all this other bullshit you read about. I can sit here and we can make clinical notes, but I don't amount to a damn. What I'm talking about is trying to help me as the simple alcoholic. How do I overcome these things? Because if you're like me, have you ever said that, by God, this is never going to happen to me again, and then 6 months down the road, there it is, you see? And as I was jokingly saying that I'm on the program, I'm not supposed to act that way, it's part of that suppression that I have. When I would have these thoughts, I would chop them off. You see, I've learned since then that when I have these thoughts, when I have this confusion and this frustration, to think it all the way through as far as I can, because then I have the whole story. Then I can make an honest evaluation about how I feel about something, not in an emotional reaction. Because as long as I was suppressing these thoughts and these things that were happening to me with the emotional identification to them, I was always constantly trying to suppress those things. I've got to overcome this stuff. I'm not supposed to act that way. This is how all of these things are going. And so as I get these problems, as I get these emotional things, I think them through. Where are they coming from? You see, then I can make that honest evaluation. And so this word honesty has expanded into many areas of my life, you see. When I came here, I had a definition of the word freedom, meaning to be free from something. And now I'm free to experience. Now I'm free to look at. Because when I got into that politics and that moral inventory, I began to see this politics of living, not Democrats or Republicans, but into the politics of living, because you'll hear manipulation used in AA. You'll hear these setups, game playing, and all these various things. And so this all comes under the heading for me, under this politics. How do I react when people try to politically use me to get something done? How do I politically set up myself to deal with others? And you'll find that some old-timer or somebody will come up to you and they'll say, will you be my sponsor? Now, if you're a normal drunk, the first thing that's going to go through your head is, how do I save his ass and my face at the same time? You see, this politics, this looking good, this is a part of this disease that you and I have, and I've seen it through these years, is that constantly having to look good. This politics of living, all of this integration into becoming whatever the hell I am, you see? And so the spiritual side of this program, I've discovered that 90% of spirituality is common sense. That God takes care of its 10% the minute I begin to use some common sense. And so all these things, as it says, much shall be revealed to you. It's still for me, thank God. With the longevity I have, it's still a whole total and new experience. You see, I've been presented with many concepts and many identities. And if you were like me when I went to these spiritual people of the various denominations with my problem, the frustration they would express was, I'll pray for you so that you can go to heaven. Death was not my problem. Living was my problem. You see, I had died many times. And so in trying to seek this spirituality, trying to come to understand this comprehension, I've been through all the abstracts. I've been through all the images. And today I can say that I have what they promised me in this East Valley, when they used to open the prayer, they said, Dear Heavenly Father, we come to you as a friend. Today I have a friend. Today I have a partner. Today I have a teacher, a taskmaster. Today I have a whole complete concept. Today I see it I travel all over the country and I see this AA, the overall, but yet when I talk to each individual, I see it progressing along as its individuality. You see, a program of recovery through discovery. And that discovery is what they wrote there in the book. That one is God. May you find him now. Thanks for asking me out this one.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.